get him.
Hello and welcome to Words and Pictures, the comics and animation show. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and today we're going to be talking about freedom of expression. My guest today is the executive director of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. They fight for artists and writers who have been censored, suppressed, or in some cases imprisoned. And they just recently moved their headquarters from New York to Portland. Charles Brownstein, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
So, you have an office in Portland, but you have staff all over the country working on issues of First Amendment and comics and cartoons.
We are a very small organization with a really big and important mission. We protect the First Amendment rights of the comics art form and the people that engage with it. And so here in Portland, we're three people, but our retained counsel, a guy named Bob Korn Revere, is based out in Washington, D.C., and he is a very, very high-powered attorney in the First Amendment community. He beat the FCC in the fleeting nudity Super Bowl case many years ago. We have board members all over the country, including Dale Sandali, who is an icon in intellectual property law and does a lot of work to help artists that reach out to us for help, as well as just volunteers who work with us. You know, all told, our staff is three paid full-timers and a couple of paid contractors that help us on the editorial side. So we're very lean and very frugal in being able to execute this really important mission.
Now, this sounds really heady, and I suspect that some of our listeners would wonder, who needs a legal defense organization for cartoonists and comics artists? Some people might think of comics as a very innocent medium, one that doesn't really need protections. And others might think that this is a battle that's already been fought and won decades ago when underground cartoonists like Robert Crumb and Bobby London and Phoebe Gleckner won the right to publish their more explicit stories, put them on newsstands.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that there's a few elements to your question. The first is that the fund was established 30 years ago this month.
Okay, back in the 80s.
And 30 years ago, 1986, a clerk at a comic book store in Lansing, Illinois, named Michael Coria, worked for this comic store called Friendly Frank's. And an undercover police officer came in and asked where the adult section was and went in and purchased a bunch of comics that included Robert Crumb and ElfQuest and Love and Rockets and Wonder Woman. Took them out.
Wonder Woman.
Took them out, figured out which ones they felt that they could prosecute, and created an indictment and went in and said, we are trying you for selling obscene comics. And, you know, Wonder Woman, that one, the judge said, well, this has clear satanic overtones. So it was back in that scare.
Oh.
This young clerk, just doing his job selling comics, was brought up on these charges and taken to court and ultimately convicted of selling obscene material. He was ultimately convicted of selling obscene material. And in the prosecution phase of that case, the industry came together and said, you know, this has happened before. The underground comics saw retailers being prosecuted and there was no group in the industry there to protect them. We need to make that group. And so artists and publishers came together and developed a portfolio to raise money for Michael Coria's case and hired Bert Joseph, an icon that actually worked on the Skokie ACLU case involving the right of Nazis to march because we are Americans and we allow dissent to occur. Bert Joseph litigated this case. He won on the appeal. And in the aftermath of that, the fund was born because Dennis Kitchen, who founded the organization, reasoned that this wasn't the first time comics have been prosecuted. It's not likely to be the last time. And that's been true. So for 30 years, we've seen our work grow to defend retailers like Michael, to defend artists who are facing prosecution for their work. Right now, there's a Kickstarter supporting a documentary about Michael Diana, who was a cartoonist in the 1990s that was convicted of making obscene comics. And
this
told,
was in Florida, right?
It was in Florida and told that he couldn't draw. The fund worked
so
on that case.
He was enjoined from drawing anything.
He was enjoined from drawing anything as part of his conditions of probation. You know, those are the historical cases. And then there's a whole universe of things that we're doing today that are fighting for artists, fighting for librarians, fighting for retailers. And fortunately, we are now a mature organization with an infrastructure that allows us to defeat most of those cases before they get to court.
So it sounds like comic books have been a very tempting target for prosecutors, for law enforcement figures who are eager to show their family-friendly chops. And the idea being that maybe in the general public's eyes, all comics should be tame enough to be read by children.
Comics have gone through a number of phases. There was a long period of time where we were regarded as low-value speech, and that came out of the 1950s comic book scare that led to Senate subcommittee hearings on comics and juvenile delinquency.
Is this an actual legal term, low-value speech?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I don't know if it's a legal term, but it's an actual, you know, term of art that is used in legal contexts. Comics were regarded as low-value speech that were argued to have a media effect. And it was the first time that you really saw the argument that media can affect behavior in a way that is imitative. And comics were caught in that moral panic. And there were hearings held to determine whether comics would adversely affect youth and make them delinquent. And because of the way the testimony went, the moral panic reached a pitch where the industry was backed into the corner of, we've got to create a code that governs our material so that we don't get legislated out of existence. And that created a stigma that comics were low-value speech that lasted well into the early part of this century. And so there was this idea back when we were established in the 80s that comics somehow were afforded a lower threshold of protection than other forms of speech that we have fought to overturn. And I think in many ways have helped contribute to overturning. There is a new generation of cases that are emerging that may not be going to court, but are being litigated in our schools and libraries. I don't want my kid reading drama by Raina Telgemeier because it has a gay character in it and that doesn't agree with my family's values. You know, this is a case that comes up quite frequently. Our point of view on that kind of a case is, if you don't want your kid to read it, that's your absolute right, but you don't have the right to make that decision for other parents, and you don't have the right to overrule the professional judgment of the librarian or the teacher that put that material, you know, in there for everybody else in the community to access. And so while we're not fighting the same battles that comics are low-value speech and all comics need to be for kids, we are fighting a lot of battles about, this particular comic doesn't agree with my worldview, and I want this to be a safe place, you know, for my worldview to thrive. And the world doesn't work that way. You know, we are a society that has the right to free expression, which means that we need to be tolerant of other ideas. And if we disagree with them, we don't ban the ideas that we disagree with. We argue our case. We argue our position. And so the fund is in a position of helping the librarians who are facing repercussions in their communities advocate for their patrons, who are the ones that really need access to this material.
So the mission of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, it sounds like it's really to bring the full broad force of First Amendment protection to comics artists and publishers.
You hit it on the head. That's right.
And you have now you have an actual written mission. You are a nonprofit organization that takes donations and reaches out to other organizations and other artists.
Yeah, that's right. We if you go to cbldf.org, you can read more about our history and our work. But yeah, in a nutshell, we're a 501c3 not-for-profit organization that is designed to protect the First Amendment rights of the community engaged with comics through legal action, legal advocacy, and education. And we execute that mission by providing lawyers to people that need them, by going to court when need be to advocate for the rights of members of our community. We execute that mission by helping people that need help. The librarian that is hearing, I'm supposed to remove this book, you know, that is in my library, or I'll lose my job. Or the reader that is hearing, I just had my computer seized because my roommate turned me in and said that I have obscene material on it. Help. Or the artist that is calling and saying, I just got this cease and desist order from this giant corporation telling me that this parody I did is infringing on their rights. Help. And we help those people. We get them very good lawyers in the cases that involve law. And the reason that you don't hear about a lot of those cases is because we beat them before they have to go to court. We help the librarians and educators that are helping serve their patrons and their students with expert support that guides them through the process. And in many cases, we advocate with our partners in the First Amendment community. We're a partner in the Kids' Right to Read Project, for instance. We advocate for them and the material that they're defending so that all people have the ability to access the important things that comics has to say. You know, we're not advocating that anything goes for everybody. If you don't want something in your house, that's your absolute right as a parent. You know, you can say, I'm uncomfortable with this. I would like an alternative assignment. You know, those provisions are already there. But we are saying that it's un-American to suggest that your own personal values can override the personal values of everybody else. You know, part of living in a society that takes free expression as a core value is to be tolerant of opposing and different views, and to trust that through speech and debate, we are able to, you know, find a path that we can live together as citizens. And comics, you know, some might say, well, it's a very escapist form, or it's entertainment, or it's fluff, or whatever. Comics are a really powerful form of expression that has a very low threshold for participation. All you need to make a comic is your own native creativity, the ability to get the work done, and then access to a computer to put it out there on the internet, or access to a photocopier to put it out there as a zine. You know, even if you want to compete in the marketplace, you know, you're talking about an investment of less than $10,000 to solicit a comic, print a comic, get into comic book stores. You can't do that with TV. You can't do that with movies. You can't even do that with novels anymore. And so you see people making really powerful statements using comics, and people are responding to them. And that's where the fund will have to engage with people saying, hey, this content's a little bit too edgy. I don't want it in my community. Well, did you read it? Let's start there. And if you didn't, maybe you should. And maybe instead of trying to ban it, maybe instead of saying, I don't want Fun Home in my community, you should have a dialogue with each other about it.
The Alison Bechdel book.
That's right.
Well, whenever I go to a comics convention, I see the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund tabling there. So you have a very effective outreach to the comics community, clearly. I would imagine it's much more of a challenge to get out there and get the word out to schools and libraries. You were mentioning how schools and libraries are considered a real target for censorship these days. And in fact, I saw on your website that one of your concerns right now is an issue of librarian self-censorship.
Yeah, I think that's right. To respond to the first part of your comment, reaching out to the education world is just a matter of, we've just got to keep doing the work, you know. And so the work, as we define it, is helping people that ask us for help, anticipating problems, and creating resources to help people with those problems. And so when there's a flurry of activity that is challenging a book like this one summer, which was the Caldecott shortlister from a year ago by Mariko and Jillian Tamaki, about these 12-year-old girls coming of age. It got a lot of challenges because it talked about miscarriage and it talked about teen pregnancy. Didn't show anything, talked about it. You know, when those flurry of challenges started happening, we created resources for teachers and librarians about here's how to collect this book, here are some of the common concerns about this book, here are common defenses for those concerns, because this is valuable speech that won the award because it has something to say to the community. So we provide those resources and get them out there. And to respond to the second part of your comment about self-censorship, a lot of times there's a lot of pressure to not rock the boat. Don't bring in this book that addresses this uncomfortable area because we don't want to upset somebody, or hey, somebody's upset by this book, quietly make it disappear. We provide resources to help arm people with the knowledge to counter those things and to serve their patrons with the content that their patrons need.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and I'm talking today with Charles Brownstein. He's the executive director of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, which very recently moved their headquarters from New York to Portland. So your mission is really centered around the First Amendment, but you also reach out across borders, and you do that in more of an educational way. You're not providing lawyers to cartoonists overseas, but you're certainly getting the word out about them. One of the cause celebs I see you're working on right now is a cartoonist in Turkey named Musa Kart, and we've been hearing recently that the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, Well, he's not just a bit thin-skinned, but he's also been consolidating power. And it seems like everybody who's expressing opposition to his policies is now being labeled an enemy of the state.
Yeah, it's a horrifying situation. And the fund, you know, we're a very small organization. You know, our budget is less than $1 million a year. We don't have the resources to provide aid, you know, globally, even if our charter permitted it. You know, and our charter is really limited to legal action in the states. But as part of education, we do news gathering every day at cbldf.org about what is happening globally in comics and censorship. And we do that because there is a culture of free expression that is global and that is every situation is informed by everywhere else. And so you see what's happening in Turkey. You saw over the last year and a half, a Iranian cartoonist named Atina Farghadani spent you know, more than a year in prison for making a cartoon critical of her government. These things are important for American audiences to know about, A, for the purposes of solidarity, and B, because it's important that we value appropriately just how important the First Amendment really is. The kinds of cartooning that we have that speaks truth to power is not a thing to be taken for granted. And, you know, I think especially now people are feeling that viscerally with the results of the election. And so being informed by what is happening globally with regards to cartoonists being persecuted for exercising their free expression rights allows those of us that care about free expression to speak up, to put pressure on the people that are oppressing free expression. But also it helps clarify why free expression is so important here in the States. It's not something to be taken for granted.
Well, you mentioned the recent American election with Donald Trump ascendant. And so there has been quite a bit of talk, some of it hyperbolic, about could it happen here? Could cartoonists, could media figures become enemies of the state? Could they be branded terrorists the way they are in Turkey? And you think that's a little overblown, I think.
I think it's important to be cautious about telling ourselves worst-case scenario stories right now. The truth is it's early days. The election was 2 days ago. And we are just now in the period of processing this information. The truth is we don't know anything. We do know that the campaign rhetoric was very toxic, you know, on both sides. But I think that, you know, obviously Trump was less friendly to free expression than Clinton. But it's early days. What's important right now is to come together in support of the fact that free expression matters and to galvanize as a community behind this notion that we're neighbors. We have to listen to each other and we need to respect each other's rights to free speech. It's possible that we could be getting back to a less friendly situation for free expression, but we just don't know yet. So I think that the order of the day is not to be alarmed or alarmist. The order of the day is to be vigilant, to pay attention, and to take action at being civil towards each other. I think civility goes a really long way towards battling the kinds of toxic rhetoric that lead to First Amendment emergencies. The First Amendment works. The First Amendment was not wiped out by the Patriot Act. You know, we didn't wipe out dissent. It became difficult.
Yeah, and we did have a gag rule on librarians for a while there.
We had Section 215 that required booksellers and librarians to have to turn over access to their client records and to not speak about it. And we were active in the fight against, you know, Section 215. And I think that's about as extreme, you know, as it got. I'm not saying that everything's going to be great. I'm just saying we have a constitution that's worked for 240 years. Let's make sure it continues to work for the next, you know, 100 years.
So the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund has been really active. You've been having events around the country, and you've also put out a couple of new publications. One of them is the Liberty Annual 2016, which has contributions by a really broad range of artists, a great range of styles. And the other is a very ambitious Kickstarter project. I've just got handed it. It looks like a very informative historical book. It's called She Changed Comics. Tell us about She Changed Comics.
Sure. We're really proud of both of these projects. She Changed Comics is especially close to my heart. It is a history of the women who changed free expression in comics. It was assembled and edited by Betsy Gomez, who is our editorial director. And it tracks, in very short profiles, biographical profiles, the women who did the work to move the line of what was possible for free expression in comics. And it shows that social justice arises from free expression, and that social justice and free expression are not only compatible, but necessarily so. So the book shows cartoonists from the suffrage era cartoonists, through the underground era of women that were using the comics form to speak out about reproductive rights and to speak out about equality rights, up through the modern period of women that changed the narrative of what comics could be. People like Alison Bechdel, who we mentioned recently with Fun Home.
And yes, I've been happy to see so many friends of the show, such as Alison Bechdel and Marjan Satrapi and Jessica Abel, who are in here. Really an amazing group of past and present groundbreaking people.
We're really proud of it. And we made this book largely to spotlight that there's a tremendous heritage of women that have expanded comics. And we live in a great time for comics where you can walk in right now and discover the work of Raina Telgemeier or the work of Kelly Sue DeConnick or the work of Carla Speed McNeil or any of another, you know, range of dozens of women I could mention who are doing amazing work. We wanted this book for the people that are just starting and can go back and go, oh, here's the whole continuum. Or the people that are versed in what's happening now and can look in here and find their own heroes in history and then add their voice to it and be a part of that conversation.
It's nice to see that we're still putting these things out in wood pulp these days, that not everything is on the web, although certainly the internet must have helped you disseminate and receive information as well. There was certainly no internet for the general population back when you started in the 80s.
I think that both traditional and digital media have their place. I'm a big proponent of you know, what I call the retreat to old media. I believe that there's a affirmative value in picking up a piece of print, whereas the intimacy with a digital delivery is with the device. You know, it's and so to that degree, every article on Facebook, whether it's a, you know, 300-page thesis or a cat GIF, has equal value, you know, whereas I think when you start dealing with print, like the CBLDF Defender magazine that we publish every quarter, you know, you're creating an opportunity for somebody to affirmatively go, I'm going to invest my time in this. That's not to say that the web doesn't have value. I think that the web is very important for disseminating information promptly, inexpensively, you know, and well. But I do think that there's different value in each form, and both forms need to be explored and need to be fed.
Another nice thing about comics and zines in print is that they're more accessible to low-income folks, mm-hmm. and they can be read in the bathtub.
Well, I think that you're right about accessibility, although that is part of the power of the public library, is that libraries provide internet access and computer access to people that wouldn't otherwise have the means to receive them. I think that there's a danger in limiting your message strictly to digital means. I think there's a danger to locking yourself into an echo chamber of just the people that you agree with. And I think there's also a danger to being a Luddite and not engaging in the conversation that's happening in the electronic media, because you can just kind of lock yourself into the print format version of that echo chamber. So, you know, I think that for an organization like the Fund, and I'm sure that you experience this here at KBOO, you've got to use every method to reach people that you can to find your allies.
Anything I've missed?
Well, I think, you know, I want to return a little bit to the Liberty Annual 2016, which is in comic stores right now.
All right. Yeah, let's talk about, this is a book you put out every year, the Liberty Annual, and there are certainly some informational and historical stories in here. Well, tell us about the range.
It's all true stories, mm-hmm. and the Liberty Annual 2016 is themed Be the Change. It's got a great cover by the artist of March, Nate Powell, and another great cover by Brandon Graham. And it was co-edited by myself and Joe Keating, who is a local writer here in Portland that does a series called Shudder. And we wanted to create a book that showcased real people who made a contribution to civics. And we wanted to show true heroes that had enough belief in themselves and their society to espouse an optimistic message. And we did that knowing that the book was going to come out the Wednesday before the U.S. election, knowing that the rhetoric in our media environment was going to be very toxic, and wanting to showcase that the change begins inside of each of us. And we're not powerless to impact our world. And whether it's through art, or whether it's through political activism, or whether it's through being a role model in athletics, which is part of the stories that are in this book, you can find your personal path to be a change agent for the world that you want to see. And I think that right now, complaining isn't enough. We live at a time where people with the ability to communicate have an obligation to, with specificity, articulate the world that we want to see and to work together to achieve that world. And this book was designed as a starting point in that conversation for us.
Well, the comic is The Liberty Annual from CBLDF. The book is She Changed Comics. And the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund is here in Portland, recently moved their headquarters from New York. Charles Brownstein is the executive director. Charles, it's been great having you here in the studio.
It's been great to be here. And if you'd like to learn more, I would encourage you to please go check out cbldf.org or to find us on Facebook and Twitter at CBLDF or facebook.com/CBLDF. And if you're here in town and would like to get involved, we are always looking for volunteers that can help us perform our mission. We're a small staff, but a really big team, and that team depends on the contributions of folks like you.
Well, that's a very active shout out to all the community, and you might have some people showing up on your doorstep.
We hope so.
All right. You've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm S.W. Conser. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and at KBOO.FM. You can find an archived version of the show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at wordsandpicture. Now stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your homegrown Portland radio station.